Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Tēnā koutou katoa, it's Morin Rout and Marianne Stone here with Bookends for another week, celebrating Aotearoa writers, and so many to celebrate today. We're going to be rushing through our introduction, Marianne, to try and get all the information in.
I'm ready.
This week I'm talking with Steve Brawnius about his book on the Pokinghorn Trial of the Century, according to Steve. He's going to be here in Otatahi for the Word Festival in just 2 weeks' time. So please get online and book tickets because things are going fast. I'm also going to be interviewing Australian author and Booker Prize shortlisted author Charlotte Woods, but we're going to keep that till next week. But she's another writer that you need to get online and book tickets for. And this Friday, the 22nd, is the Phantom Bill Stickers New Zealand Poetry Day. This huge amount of events coming up all around the motu. So this is one where you really need to go on the website and check what's happening in your area. And to celebrate that, we're going to have another wonderful Christchurch poet on the show today. Philip Armstrong has a new collection called Touch Screen. And Marianne, over to you.
Fantastic. To round out the program today, I'm chatting with Lizette Raymer, who was News Hub Europe Desk journalist. It's a memoir of her time covering the Europe Desk, which has covered so many of the most amazing events over the last decade. So that's a fascinating book. I don't get danger money for this. But before we kick into the program, let's also, Morin, shout out to all the authors who were celebrated in Aotearoa's Children Book Awards, because there's an incredible richness of books from Te Ao Māori taking prizes in 6 of the 9 categories, which is really exceptional, including the overall winner, Ross Kalman, who has written an illustrated history of the Treaty of Waitangi. That took out both the Elsie Locke and the Margaret Mahe Awards, so that is obviously an exceptional book to read. And, you know, it's so cool to have a bilingual, bicultural future out there for our young New Zealand readers, and it's great to be even struggling to keep up with that. Ai tonu, ka mutu pea.
The trial of Philip Pokinghorn, eye surgeon of Remuera, came to dominate Steve Brawnius's life. From the almost daily dispatches on the proceedings to a public obsessed with knowing every sordid detail, Steve has now produced a book promising to take us inside the trial of the century. On the cover, we are told Steve is New Zealand's finest crime writer, and I'm not disputing that, but he is, of course, a lot of other things. He's a journalist, he's the author of 14 books, winner of many awards for his columns, and literary editor of Newsroom. I'm glad to see, Steve, that you are now back in the listener.
Yes, I'm thrilled to be back in that magazine. It's kind of a home for me, so
it's a return. Yeah, and it's nice to have you there. And, of course, you are about to travel to Otatahi to appear at the Word Festival with Leanne Dalziel. Now, this is going to be an interesting pairing.
Yes, I was asked by the Christchurch Word people if I had, you know, a couple of names to suggest as chair, and I begged them to secure the services of Leanne, who is, you know better than I do, an awesomely smart and able person with a very nimble mind. She's an individualist, and I think she will hopefully not quite put me on the rack, Moran, but I know that she'll be wanting to challenge me on a number of things.
Well, that always makes for the best sessions in my mind. We don't want people cosily agreeing with each other, do we?
Well, yeah, many appearances on the literary festival circuit are a kind of orgy of agreement and can be quite dull. But yes, Leanne and dullness do not live in the same room.
No. Well, I can just urge all those in Otatahi and those outside of Otatahi to get to your session and hear you being grilled. You, of course, vowed never to write another book of this nature, but you've been lured out by Philip Polkinghorne and his life. I'm just leaving it there as a very crude approximation of what lured you out. And I'm thinking I'm sure we're going to see you coming up from time to time. Look at Helen Garner, who's been lured out by the mushroom murders.
Has she? I didn't know that. Oh, how great. Oh gosh.
Yes, exactly.
You'd want to read pretty much every word she wrote about anything, wouldn't you?
I know.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, well, you know, I'd written three collections of crime writing, and the last one only came out last year. And as it was coming out, I vowed, you know, I couldn't do this again for a lot of reasons. Just didn't want to be associated with crime and the criminal courts. Not because I was like, you know, feeling, you know, that it was dragging me down or that I was taking it home. It wasn't like that. It was more like I just realized that I wasn't able to relate to a lot of the people being accused of these crimes. You know, they were typically pretty lower socioeconomic, really disadvantaged. They were strangers to the whole courtroom system. And I was feeling as though I was just being exploitative. And it was kind of, you know, a middle-class person preying on the misfortunes of the lower classes. Polkinghorne dragged me out of that because, of course, he's a total anomaly. He is a very wealthy man. And his whole lifestyle, which was laid bare during the trial because it was considered, you know, of utmost relevance to the prosecution, was the lifestyle of a man who was very wealthy. He's an eye surgeon. I think one year he billed around about $750,000, and he had extensive tastes. He pleaded guilty to possessing 37.7 grams of methamphetamine, which cost around about $50,000. And, of course, one of the probably the most shocking statistic, if you could call it that, in the trial, was that his sex spend was toted up, which is to say the police hired a forensic accountant. I didn't know there were such things. And she calculated how much Philip had spent on sex workers. And it came to a very specific and exact total, and it was around about $298,000. So with all this sort of lavish spending, this upper-class lifestyle, I had no qualms about reporting on this and immersing myself in this. In fact, I felt, you know, I'm a lot poorer than Philip, but I felt very comfortable with writing about, you know, a professional class. So I didn't have that cross to bear. And then there was just the fact that it was so relentlessly interesting. You know, when I started the trial, I thought, oh, I'll just pop along for a couple of days, you know, maybe in the first week and pop along maybe for a day in the second week. And, of course, I never left. it was just so interesting. I didn't want to do anything else with my life than to sit in that courtroom and listen to the unfolding prosecution and then the surprising and more influential defence of Philip Polkinghorne.
Yes, that's, I mean, I didn't follow it, really. I was aware of it, but I didn't follow it. I don't know why, it doesn't matter. I've read about it now, and it is quite extraordinary how the defence was able to, well, I mean, you describe it, the prosecution failed in their job of finding him guilty, because the defence did a good job, but the prosecution, it seemed to me, failed more than the defence.
I mean, you can only work with the materials you got, I suppose. I mean, what had happened, of course, is that Dr. Polkinghorne's wife, Pauline, died on April 5, 2021. He phoned the emergency services that morning on 111 and said, "My wife has hung herself." The responders came to the house, including police, and they very quickly became suspicious that he had perhaps staged the hanging, that he had killed her with his bare hands and then created this elaborate and sickening hoax where she had hanged herself. It took 16 months for the police to charge him with that murder. That's a very, very long time. That's an extremely long time. And they were all over the house for 6 days, you know, day and night, the ESR combing for forensic evidence for at least a week. Then they had all those months on top of it. And really what they had when it came down to the trial is that they had this great story, you know?
Yeah.
They had this fascinating, interesting story of a very strange little man who wore vivid socks and a different bow tie every day to work, who drove a Porsche with a personalized number plate, and who they discovered had, you know, spent a hell of a lot of money on sex workers, including a woman called Madison Ashton, who was going to be the star of the trial, the star prosecution witness. She's a sex worker in Sydney. Her and Philip ended up having a relationship. And the motive, according to the police, is that Philip killed Pauline to be with Madison. So what a great story. It was like they ran it like a tabloid story, you know. It was like the Herald on Sunday newspaper put into a courtroom. What they didn't have was convincing forensic information, and that's what the defence had. The defence called two forensic pathologists, really smart people, very plausible, experts in their field, and they both said, if we had conducted the autopsy on Pauline Hanna, we would have given a ruling of we would not have given a ruling of manual strangulation or homicide. So it was kind of like this terrific story versus these
cold
emphatic,
hard facts. Yeah,
these cold hard facts. And the jury, who are a terrific jury in as much they were so attentive, they took voluminous notes, they listened, only one of them fell asleep. They were pushed into a corner. You know, they took their job and their task and the limitations seriously, which is, you know, beyond reasonable doubt. And Polkinghorne's lawyer, Ron Mansfield, KC, played this beyond reasonable doubt like a fiddle and played very bewitching tunes on it to the degree that, yeah, the jury, I think it's fair to say, Moran, they delivered their verdict with extreme reluctance. I don't think that they liked Philip Polkinghorne very much. but they had to do their job. And you know, criminal justice, criminal law was observed. You can only go on what you were given in evidence. And what they were given, it was clearly a verdict of not guilty.
Not enough. What I'm interested in, Steve, is, as I said, it was virtually daily dispatches on your behalf, written often on your phone. Now, you know, once the verdict's been come to pass, then you take all your experiences, all your emotions, all your rational thoughts, all those things, and then you put it into a book. What is that process like?
Fun. Pure enjoyment, as it was writing these diaries of the trial at the time. And just as a sort of an aside, Maureen, this whole business I was doing during the trial, I would take the bus home. I don't drive, and I don't have a laptop. Don't believe in them. I would write the story on my phone, you know, on the bus, and file it just as I was getting to my stop at home. And not one of the reasons I did it, but one of the inspirations behind doing it that way was because of something that happened during the Christchurch earthquakes. A Christchurch writer, David, his first name was, brilliant guy, absolutely brilliant. He wrote a story for The Guardian about the earthquakes while they were happening on his phone with two fingers. And he wrote this, you know, raw, beautifully composed, instant reaction to this tragedy that was unfolding. And he wrote it in the dark. And also that was terribly inspiring, and that was sort of the guiding spirit, you know, to write the daily diaries of this trial on my phone. But yeah, subsequent to that, the trial had finished. I took a few days off, tried to, you know, go back into normal life, whatever that was. And then I, after even just 3 days, I began to really miss the trial and miss the experience, and I wanted to relocate that feeling. And sat down and wrote the book over the next 8 weeks.
8 weeks, goodness.
Mm.
Yeah, because
is that fast? Slow? What do you
well,
think?
I don't know. I'm not a writer, but it sounds fast to me. But if you're wanting to capture and retain that sense of the, you know, momentum, then of course you'd want to do it like that. And you,
I guess so.
You really revel in the camaraderie of the people around you, don't you? The court staff, the lawyers, the KCs, the people who come on a daily basis, all those relationships, and witnesses that you get to know. So, you know, that must be hard to leave behind.
Trials are very human events. This was an eight-week trial, so there must have been around about 50 witnesses. So people coming and going all the time, and New Zealand being New Zealand, you know, there'd be these small degrees of separation with some of the witnesses. You know, one of them was Polkinghorne's cleaner. The cleaner in their household was a woman who I know called Cheryl Morris, who used to run Pagan Records. They had lots of number one hits back in the 80s, 90s. And so forth. I loved all these people coming in with their different stories. Their own sort of background was relevant. I remember the defense called Polkinghorne's financial advisor, as well as his personal trainer. And a lot of these people were coming in, and, you know, I'd be sitting there going, gee, you know, I wish I had their services, you know. Polkinghorne's financial advisor made him rich. Wouldn't that be great to have? But the catch is, of course, you've got to be rich in the first place. They just right. make you rich.
They don't want to know you if you're not.
No, I tried to chat with him afterwards, and he couldn't get away from me fast enough. But it was fun and enjoyable to recreate that whole experience while writing the book. And I 8 weeks, that isn't a long time, is it? The fact is, and it's a strength and definitely a weakness. I'm a fast writer, Moran. I think that's the best way I can write. I'm not, when I have time to consider things and to be patient and ponder, my writing is quite wooden, it's flat, and it's kind of boring. And it doesn't address the sort of emotional truths of a story when I've got time to think about it. When I've got virtually very little time to think about things, that's when I think the best that I can anyway.
Well, putting aside, and I know we shouldn't, the absolute tragedy of Pauline's death and whether she got justice herself, God, all that is enormous. But Polkinghorne himself was the best figure of fun you could come across, really, wasn't he? I know we should remember his humanity as well, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too. I mean, the trial is over and Pauline is dead. And you're talking about things in a past tense. But it's a continuing thing. We happen to be speaking while I am in the North Shore District Court in Auckland. I'm in a little room off the court. The reason I'm here is that this morning of our interview, I attended a pre-inquest hearing in the matter of Pauline Hannah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yes. It was a conference call to establish some of the rules for the full inquest, which is going to be heard in August next year. And the inquest is to determine the cause of death. So to Pauline's friends and families, this is a belated but very important and very significant and profound attempt for them to find justice.
I think we could talk for 3 or 4 days and still not get to the bottom of anything, but thank you for the work you've done. The book is called Polkinghorne, Inside the Trial of the Century. It's written by Steve Brawnius and published by Allen and Unwin.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Jacob's Ladder. Midday, midweek, mid-scroll and touch-screened far too long. I'm struck so flat, I'm lying face up on the carpet when something reveals itself. Above me, showing only when my eyes drift, hangs a single thread of spider silk. It traces a deliberate cursive in the draughtless room. And with that, I'm snatched up like a kiting spiderling through the ceiling, through cloud stacks. Beneath my feet, the mundane province drops away, blank and featureless as an untapped display. The troposphere turns out to be far from nothing, packed with scents and multi-storied matter. The wind's guts jostle. Muscles rip at every turn, registering memories for future reference. I'm washed along an atmospheric river, spun into the eddy with the residues. A stagnant bay, black rainbow surfaced, holds a liquid mulch of all the phonemes ever uttered. Phrases decompose, leach into clouds, contaminate the humid air, the aquifers. I wait until I get the flesh's message, breathe deeply, and start to climb one ache at a time. up off the floor.
That was Otatahi poet Philip Armstrong reading from his latest collection entitled Touch Screen. It's his second collection and his first won the Kathleen Grattan Poetry Award. He teaches literature, writing and human-animal studies out at the University of Canterbury. And I have to say, Philip, you shouldn't remark on the covers of books, but you've chosen a Joanna Braithwaite painting of two snakes entwined with a laptop. It sounds odd, doesn't it? You have to see it to see it.
But everyone comments on the cover.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's a good thing.
That's Joanna's. Is it? I think so. And when I came across that image, I thought, oh, that it's just so ideal. The snakes, it should be said, have a great deal of personality.
Yeah, they do. They're communicating with one another, in the middle is that laptop, and we are so entwined in our relationships.
Well, it's an apple.
Yes. Of course it is an apple.
These snakes are offering us an apple.
And we've taken it, haven't we?
We've taken it.
Boy, have we ever taken it. Mm. So that poem, you know, in lots of ways, that encapsulates a lot of the things that you're dealing with in this collection. And it also shows us how you kind of move from the natural world into the world of thoughts and words and data and info and whatever.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to read that one, but also why it comes quite early in the collection. Thank you. That's a beautiful way to put it. I think the poems are interested in those interconnections, the sort of, you know, inside ecology, what goes on in our minds and our bodies, and then what goes on between our bodies and the rest of the ecology, the rest of the environment, and the way that I guess one of the things, you know, the whole collection, I think, is interested in that kind of relationship. All my poems seem to focus on that. But also, at least some of the poems in this collection, as the title indicates and that cover indicate, are sort of interested in how the digital world and our digital devices intervene in that or make a difference to that or block that in some ways, you know, that a touch screen sort of is what promises to put us in touch with all these incredible virtual digital worlds, but in other sorts of ways it's a screen between that screens us from our relationship, from being in touch with the rest of the world. You know, all the time that we spend in the digital world, we're not in touch with the world around us, the physical world, the material world, the living world around us, which I worry about a bit.
Yeah, it is worrying, isn't it? Because it's always there. It's we're so easily diverted from the natural world into the technological world. Yes. And people are finding it harder and harder to separate the two out.
Finding it harder to separate the two out and subject to, you know, devices that are really designed to capture us, to capture our attention and keep us as much in the world that's created for us online as possible. And I think poetry, on the other hand, I mean, the other thing that I suppose the title is playing with a wee bit is the idea that poetry is a kind of touch screen too. It's a way of, you know, it's like a screen that we project ideas onto, but also poetry can put us in touch with, poetry creates virtual worlds for us. But hopefully too, poetry puts us back in touch with our senses and with our bodies, and I think I think there's probably, I mean, you can never generalize about poetry because every poem is different and it's such a wide, you know, it's the widest possible kind of art form. But certainly any poem that I like is always at some point about the world outside and the relationship between the world outside us and the world inside us. And it's about touch and it's about the senses and it's about smell and taste as well as just vision. It sort of helps us re-embody ourselves, I think, poetry at its best. It's quite a sensual form.
It is.
I think.
And the manipulation of language is such an important part of that. That's what I think I read poetry for as much as anything, is what a poet can do with language and how they can.
Yes, and that's a very sensory experience,
oh,
isn't
boy,
it? You know,
it
you
is.
Can feel it in your body. When
mm.
you read a good line of poetry, you get the prickle on the neck or you get the goosebumps or it is a physical experience. And poetry, you know, through the sound of the words can be, poetry is sort of restoring to words their sensuality. I think not very often that a poem that's very abstract is appealing to us.
No.
Again, you'd never say never, but I can't think of one.
I agree. If I don't have an emotive reaction, I suppose, to the first reading of a poem, unless I have a duty to read it again, I may not go back to it. And that's, I think, one of the strong senses I had at the end of reading your book was that I had read them all through without sort of taking too much time with each poem. But then going back to them, and I knew as I read through that there was a wealth of things to be discovered when I went back. And sure, there was, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really, really glad to hear that. It's wonderful.
Yeah, well, it is the joy of it. But it's got the poems need to do something on that first reading to you.
Yes.
Don't they?
I think so. And, yeah, I think they do. And there's a few ways of doing that. And a lot of contemporary poetry does that through humour. It's very funny. Which is fantastic. And I think a lot of contemporary poetry is very influenced by the spoken word poetry, which is so vibrant. And also, you know, maybe a bit influenced by stand-up comedy and things like that and performance. That's not something that I can do. So for me, I guess I do that a bit. I mean, you know, plenty of other people do this too, but for me, I quite like a poem that tells a story. And so a lot of the poems in here are sort of little narratives. Even that one that I read, it's not much of a story. It's about somebody who's a bit sick of being online and lies on the ground and sees, you know, that they haven't been cleaning the cobwebs off the ceiling and then goes into this sort of imaginative journey up into the sky
and then
back into the body. So there's a story, there's a narrative arc to it, and I sort of can't help doing that. I think I myself love poems that tell stories and that take you somewhere, and that you end up in a different place from where you started. So that's something that hopefully, at least some of the poems, that's something that a reader can grasp first time through.
Yes.
And they can have an experience of being taken on a little
trip. On a little trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and then maybe some of the other stuff that might or might not be going on. If they're interested enough in that trip for a revisit, then they can, you know, see other things.
And there's plenty to see. You are funny too.
Thank you.
Shall I call you droll or no? It's sort of beyond droll, really.
I'm not afraid of droll.
No, droll's a good word.
Droll's a good word.
I agree. But
I guess some of it is. I think one of my favourite genres is satire, and so there's certainly some, I can't really help being satirical about things, and it's a hard world at the moment not to be satirical about.
There's plenty of material out there.
So
don't have to look far.
So there's a bit of that in there. And there's a few poems that are certainly jokes at my own expense.
Yes,
which
there
is have a rich
about
source.
About falling over.
There's a lot of poems
falling
about
up.
Because I'm a very, very clumsy person. And, you know, if somebody falls over and they don't hurt themselves, that can be quite funny. Although there is one poem in here that which is about how terrible I am and have always been at sport. And I was made to play sport at school. And so there's a poem in here about that. And it's meant to be funny. But I read it out on one occasion to an audience of people, and there was a shocked silence at the end of it because I think everybody thought, oh, God, we can't laugh at that.
He's been laughed at all his life.
They'd be laughing at me. So nowadays if I read that one, I say, look, you know, if you find it funny, you're welcome to laugh. It's only me.
Now, I just need to talk about one of the poems or sequence of poems that's in the section Myth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, about clay, life of clay, because it references Frankenstein but brings Frankenstein very much into our new digital world.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've always been entranced and influenced and astonished by the novel Frankenstein, which is, you know, Mary Shelley, you know, she started writing it at the age of 18, finished it at 20, and somehow she managed to write this novel which produced the story that just became the story that we tell about our relationship to technology and science and all those things. And so I just imagined that maybe the creature doesn't die, as he said to at the end of the novel. You know, he's been chased into the Arctic by his creator, Victor Frankenstein. And maybe he doesn't die, maybe he just gets frozen in the ice. And then, of course, 2 centuries later, climate change comes along and melts the ice and he comes back to life. And so he has some more adventures and tells us about those. And so that's the story of that little sequence of poems. And again, it's just this narrative created by Mary Shelley, which is so versatile and vivid and so kind, so sort of haunting, because the creature is monstrous in certain ways, but we feel so sorry for him, such empathy. That's what the novel is about. It's about, you know, do you feel empathy for this creature or do you feel, you know, he's a monster?
Mm.
And so, you know, that's, how can that not be worth writing poems about?
Well, it's really moving, really thought-provoking, like almost all the poems in this collection. We need to look at a poem to end.
Okay.
And I'm wondering what you think is the appropriate poem.
Well, maybe just a brief one. What about a poem about swimming? Because I guess what we haven't talked about, there's the last section of the book, which is really about environments and places and what it's like to be in places. And so this one is just about going swimming on Sumner Beach. Some people swim there in the winter. I swim there in the summer, but it's still really cold.
I love swimming. I think I've said it a million times on this program, especially to everybody who writes about swimming.
Right. Well, and I always write about the ocean so much. And swimming, of course, you just, totally immersed.
Yeah.
In I mean, we're always immersed in our environment, but you can't not notice that you're immersed. You have to be aware of being immersed in your environment when you're swimming.
It's such a restorative and healing
thing. And it changes
things, the
whole sort of constitution of your body and how you feel in your body in a moment.
It certainly does. Yeah. And I'm like you, I'm a summer swimmer. Every year I think I'm going to be a winter swimmer, but...
Oh, help.
Yes.
I never even consider it. But, you know, you've got to have your wits about you swimming at Sumner because it's cold. And the waves are, it's never still. And there's strong currents. And the waves are always, you know, the water's always trying to do something to you. So you can't not pay attention, which is good for us, I think.
It is good.
Yeah. So this poem's called Surface Tension. Dive into the breaker. Now, the ocean's whole cold body, which is pelt and innards, guts, teeth and saliva all at once, enfolds your every millibar of skin. So it feels like you'll never not feel cold again. Until a minute later, when the ocean warms to you.
Thank you, Philip. And Philip is one of, I mean, we're celebrating world poet, well, not world, should be world, National Poetry Day on Friday, 22nd of August. And it's a day to discover new poets. It's a day to celebrate old poets. It's a day just to get yourself some poetry, read it, and be delighted by it. So thank you, Philip, for
doing all those things.
Philip's latest collection is called Touchscreen by Philip Armstrong, of course, and published by Otago University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
No, I Don't Get Danger Money is Kiwi journalist Lisette Raymer's memoir of her time as News Hub's Europe correspondent. It lets us behind the scenes of news footage recording for many of the past decade's most important international events. In it, we witness the chaotic, adrenaline-charged race against time in extreme circumstances that is the work of news teams so we can watch history unfold. Now back in Auckland, Lisette joins us this morning for what could be one of the tamest interviews of her life, by all accounts. Tēnā koe, Lisette. Thank you so much for the stories and for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Cool. So I think our listeners would love, firstly, just to hear what made you choose journalism as a career.
Oh, honestly, I don't remember choosing it. It was always the plan. And I've tried to remember what sparked it, but it was always what I was going to do. And I don't remember making it an active decision to become a journalist. I always, you know, grew up in a house that was focused around the 6 p.m. news bulletin. It was really important to my parents and my grandparents even. And so maybe that sparked a sort of connection with the news because they had so much respect and passion for it that maybe I just subconsciously kind of took that on. But my oldest brother, also went to broadcasting school, and he's 10 years older than me. So he was probably already getting involved in the industry when I was very, very young. And I was probably a little bit inspired by him or wanted to follow in his footsteps. But yeah, I've just always loved telling stories. I'm a little bit of a peacock. So it just made sense.
Gorgeous. There's so much behind the events that are unfolding. As a journalist, you know, you talk about, you know, a little bit of a peacock. There's so much more to it than that. Do you feel a responsibility to become something of a student of history for everything that you're covering? Like, how do you cope with that? How do you kind of know that you're fully in the picture about what you're reporting on?
Yeah, I guess that's one part of my personality that's perhaps helped me over the years, is I do have this habit of becoming quite obsessed with things. So I do these crazy deep dives on really random topics all the time. I become super obsessed with it, maybe for a week or a month.
Yeah.
And then I'll move on to the next thing. But I do really throw myself all in on one thing. And journalists, traditionally, we're juggling a bunch of different topics and we jump from one to one a lot and very quickly, but getting kind of fully immersed in something and across it really quickly and soaking up all that information has always been a strange skill of mine and something I love doing. So yeah, as soon as I get a new story, you really quickly have to get the basic information. But when it's a big story like what I was covering in Europe, those really, really dense topics, especially when it's building on long-standing history like what's happened in Israel and Gaza or Ukraine and Russia, there's years and years of history that is relevant to telling those stories. And of course, there is an obligation to be well across everything so that you're reporting what's happening now with the correct context and responsibly.
Yeah, cool. And that comes across in your writing, even though this writing is really lighthearted about kind of what it's like to make those stories, to be there making those stories, or lighthearted, but, you know, there's a lot of serious weight and you do get that respect for, you get an enormous respect for the news as the kind of foundation as well. The sadness and the grief and the depression surrounding many of the events is really tangible in the book, especially in the wake of Turkey's earthquake, for example, but, you know, also in the Ukraine. Can you describe for the readers the necessary mindset of a journalist in the face of that?
Yeah, I think, and I hope, you know, that's kind of the spirit of the book, really, is that I have always been a really positive, upbeat person. I love to have a laugh and I love to, you know, joke around. And I think that ability to stay positive, even when you're dealing with these really, really hard topics, has been crucial to kind of surviving that period of storytelling. But I think, honestly, when you're on the ground and immersed in those situations, you're on a real mission. It's you're kind of you've got a job, and a lot of the time we'd just spent weeks convincing and begging our bosses to let us go and cover this stuff and making the budgets work and proving the logistics were possible, that by the time you're there, you're not really thinking, wow, this is really sad, or I'm really tired, or this is really scary. You're just thinking, finally, we're here. We can do the job. We can get these really important stories out. And you're not, you don't have time necessarily to stop and really process what you're dealing with. It's probably only now writing the book or reflecting that I'm properly realizing, and it's registering just how traumatic a lot of that was. But I think you are really focused on the job at hand. And there are moments, of course, where the weight of it hits you and it's really, really hard to deal with. And I talk about that in the book, that it was often when I got back to London and I was alone, it would all kind of come crashing down on me and I would have to kind of deal with it. But when you're there, you are really focused on just doing the best possible job and justifying the fact that the bosses have spent so much money getting you there and have trusted you to go to a dangerous place and kind of carrying the weight of all of that with them as well. So you want to prove that it was worth it so that you can keep on going and keep on telling those stories, because you know, in New Zealand's case, not many people are telling those stories for Kiwis.
The news has to work quite hard to justify its role these days, doesn't it? You talk about that, you know, like having to push to make your case, to be there, to get on the ground and tell those stories. That feels like the news is having to work harder than ever to justify why that matters.
Yeah, it's not so much justifying why it matters. I think everybody understands how important these stories are and how important it is that we're telling them. But the reality is that it's super, super expensive to tell those stories. The most important stories to tell are the hardest to tell because they're logistically difficult to get to and they're really blooming expensive. Mm. And at the moment, the media industry doesn't have a whole lot of free cash going around. Mm. So it's way, way harder to tell those stories, which is, yeah, at the moment, the toughest part of my job.
Mm. The book is full of such fascinating anecdotes for news lovers. There's a moment on the anniversary of Ukraine when, kind of out of duty or solidarity to get the news to Kiwis, the teams of Clarissa Ward and Christine Amanpour from CNN double for you in Kiev. It's a wonderful little, just one little moment in all of the book. But what's the foundation of that kind of solidarity in the news community, do you think?
Well, at the time, Warner Brothers, who owned News Hub, also owned CNN. We were kind of in the same family. So there was a relationship there based on the company. But also we had, of course, been seeing those guys every time we'd gone to Ukraine, and whenever we'd gone into kind of a Turkey location, or when we went to Israel, we were always working with the CNN guys because they're so experienced and they're a massive beast of an operation, and we're just little old New Zealand trying to keep up with the big guys. So there was a real camaraderie there. But also, you know, when you're dealing in hostile environments, of course, there's some competition between networks, especially the big Americans internally, I'm sure. But in the end, you're sharing information with each other that can be life-saving, and you kind of have to leave a little bit of the competition at the door when you're confiding in each other with information that, yeah, don't stay at that hotel. We know that it's not safe anymore. You know, don't go out to that side. We know that there are sympathizers there that are causing trouble on the Far East or whatever it might be. That information and the word of mouth that's shared among journalists in those environments is super important, and it is shared willingly.
Yeah, no, it's fabulous. One of the things, and you do kind of hint at this, but I was wondering about the times when you really nervous that you haven't captured enough to convey anything significant. There's so much like effort to get there and get on the ground and kind of be ready to capture anything, you know. And so the times when you might feel like, gosh, I haven't captured enough, when you're stretching to give meaning to the footage that you've got, what's that pressure feel like? And you know, or do you always, in those circumstances, kind of does professionalism override, and you kind of just find the right thing to say, or like, how's that?
I think you're always desperate to get the best story out possible, and I think what you're experiencing is so jaw-dropping firsthand. The experience is, it seems, you know, you're so consumed by what you're covering and you want everyone at home, and you feel a responsibility to convey how significant it is to people on the other side of the world, as in New Zealanders, and make them feel as close to it as you're feeling. Like, you're kind of like the representative for New Zealand on the ground of what it's like and how significant it is. And so you want to bring Kiwis as close to that story and make it feel as close to them as it does to you. So there's a huge pressure in that, making sure that the story is as powerful as what it feels like for you in person. And you're just constantly battling so many different things to make that story as powerful as possible. For a while, we were stuck in Kyiv, which is the capital of Ukraine, which of course is still getting hit by missiles, but I knew that, you know, that wasn't the most affected area. We wanted to get to the front line where things were really, really bad. And that was the story I wanted to bring to Kiwis. I didn't just want to show them the 50-50 life of some people. You know, there's the odd missile, but there's not this all-consuming, hellish environment that there is in the Far East. So you're pushing to get to further out, but of course that costs money. There is huge safety implications with that. And it's the same, you know, and when we were in Israel, obviously no one's still been able to get into Gaza, but there's a huge burden there because you know that the main story isn't happening in Israel, it's happening in Gaza. So there is never, or even in Ukraine, we had the situation where I knew that a member of our team was trying to affect our storytelling because he was Russian, he had Russian leanings, and he was trying to sabotage the degree of which we were able to show New Zealanders what the Russians had been doing in Ukraine. And I knew that was impacting the story, and that was really difficult. I don't know if you're ever fully satisfied with a story. It's very rarely that you'd look at it and say, okay, that was perfect. It couldn't have been better. That's just, I think, part of the
It's so unpredictable, eh? It's so unpredictable there on when you're doing that work and so yeah, there's so many things that are out of your control. On your cover notes, you say, and I'm just going to read out loud here, "I wake up every day expecting to fall asleep in a different country, a blur of breaking news, airports, body armour, border crossings and bomb shelters and wads of foreign cash. We were charging on adrenaline and there was no place we wouldn't have gone." You go on, but you finish, "I would have done it all for free." Okay, and it's a powerful description of the how energizing you found this work. And I guess I can understand the rush of that. But I wonder with now, you know, with when you're safe and away from it all, whether you're as keen to rush back into it. Like, because it also sounds like the whole book sounds like that was a life under unbelievable pressure and stress and at times real trauma as well. So, like, you would have done it for free, but are you desperate to get back into it?
Yeah. I think about it every day. It's really hard, honestly. It's really, really hard. It's hard to be so far away from it all. You feel a lot of guilt that you've kind of ditched it, that you're not telling those stories like you should be or you feel you should be. I think kind of coming home, there's been lots of really positive things to come out of returning to New Zealand. I obviously, like, I'm very aware, and I knew the whole time that job wasn't sustainable. I needed a circuit breaker. And I said all along to the bosses, "I'm never going to opt out of this job, so you'll have to bring me home." And in the end, you know, News Hub got shut down, so it was not the circumstances any of us had imagined. But I think in a lot of ways it has been good for my health to come home and have a little bit of a reset and, recover, I think, a little bit from the burnout that I didn't even know I was experiencing. But, yeah, that fire is lit in me now, and it's really hard to just, you know, turn that off. And I'm still a news junkie, so I'm still covering it all the time and watching it all the time. And yeah, you want to be at the heart of it, and you want to be telling those really, really important stories. So it is hard.
So no recovery from being a live world news journalist. Which is good to hear, because it's a special quality, I'm sure, and thank you very much for all the stories. So much to talk about. Everything that matters in these past years that you've covered, all the incidental minutiae that the book captures, the wild political fevers of the French, and there's the modesty of Danish celebrations. There's a lot of cultural richness in your telling of the story. So thank you for that, because it's very entertaining to read. The book is I Don't Get Danger Money by Lisette Raymer, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. And thank you very much for joining us to talk about it this morning, Lisette.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.